Here we go. On the Word of the Buddha, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, we're up to the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, which is on right mindfulness, Sammasati. And the explanation is mostly given here from the Satipatthana Sutta. And as many of you know, that is a bit of a controversial sutta. It has been emphasized very much in recent years. And there are some translations which are very, very clearly not that accurate. But don't disbelieve me. You can always check these things out for yourself. So here we go. What now is right mindfulness, or sati? The first of all, the four foundations of mindfulness, satipatthana, or I like calling the stations of consciousness, the focuses of consciousness, if you like, mindfulness. Now they have here, I'll read it out first away, then take it to bits. The only way that leads to the attainment of purity, to the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, to the end of pain and grief, to the entering upon the right path and the realization of nirvana is by these four foundations of mindfulness. And what are these four? And those of you who have heard me before, or at least know what's going on in Buddhism, know that straight away, when it says the only way, that is so controversial that basically that anyone who says it's the only way really just hasn't got any ground to stand on. The word is ekayana. And for those of you who are at all interested in Pali, know that that is like a basic, almost like schoolboy mistake. Because if it's ekayana, one vehicle, single vehicle, fine. But it's ekayana, which means like a one-going, ayana. And the only other place where it is used in the whole of the Sutta Pitaka is in Sutta number 12, the Mahasayanada Sutta, which I'll just read out the one particular place where it is written, and then you will understand about why, what it actually really means. And this is from the shorter discourse on, sorry, the longer discourse on the Lion's Roar, number 12. If one of the powers of Tathagata, where is it going? Okay, on the five destinations, here we go. By encompassing mind with mind, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body after death, they will reappear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. And later on, with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses a human, I see that on the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in such states, and is experiencing exclusively painful, racking, piercing feelings. Just explaining how this is. Suppose there were a charcoal pit, deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same charcoal pit. Then a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that he will surely come to this same charcoal pit. And later on he sees he has fallen in the charcoal pit. So, you can see that it's a very simple simile, but the important word here is came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same charcoal pit. So you can see what that, this is the word ekayana. It's like it's one way, no branches this way or another way. So it's like a direct way, and I think it's what Bhikkhu Buddha says, a direct path. Yes. But it certainly does not mean the only way. And that was actually quite a mischievous, I would call it, sort of translation there. Because there is another part, another place where the Buddha says the only way, and I've mentioned this many times in my talks, and that is in the Dhammapada, in the Magga chapter, Maggawaka it's called, the chapter on the Eightfold Path. There the Buddha actually says, Ezo wa Maggo Nati Anyo Dasa Nasa Visuddhiya, which literally means Ezo this, referring to the Eightfold Path. Wa means only. Magga, path. Nati Anyo, there is not another. Dasa Nasa Visuddhiya, for the purity of insight. And that is the, that is classic Buddhism, the only way, Eightfold Path. So the mindfulness is an important part of it. But when he says the only way, they really sort of a bit mischievous there. So I've got on here from Bhikkhu Bodhi, this is the direct path, leads to attainment of, to the attainment of purity, to the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, to the end of pain and grief, the entering upon the right path and realization of Nibbana, the four foundations or focus of the mindfulness. And what are these four? Herein the disciple dwells in contemplating the body, contemplation of feeling, contemplation of mind objects, ardent, that's atapi, clearly comprehending them and mindful, sampajanya and satima, after putting away worldly greed and grief. And many of you should know that that particular phrase is loke abhija domanasan. I say vinaya. Vinaya loke abhija domanasan. Vinaya is, for those of you who know Pali or Latin, is a gerund. It means explaining something which has been completed, having been done. So having done something, it is put away, having given up, and it's loke abhija domanasan, was first translated by Rice Davis as worldly greed and grief. No, actually, it's covetousness and grief. That's when, and actually put the loke, covetousness and grief for the world. However, one of the great advantages of actually learning some Pali and reading things in Pali is that certain things stand out to you, which is not apparent when you read the English. Because this is my own experience learning Pali, and I started to read his books in Pali, and I knew this loke abhija and domanasan. And then when I came across all of these descriptions of the five hindrances, the five nivaranas, and about these come up so often in the suttas, hundreds of times, and about half the time the first hindrance is sensory desire, usually kamachanda, was actually loke abhija. I said, I've seen that somewhere before, loke abhija. It was used as one of the two ways of describing the first hindrance. So here we have in the Satipatthana, it means having put away, having abandoned the first hindrance. And then we've got Domanasa. What does that mean? And Domanasa literally means like bad mind. It can mean anything. But it is used in two suttas in the Sutta Pitaka. When I read it, oh, here we go again. In the list of five hindrances, Domanasa was number two. It was a synonym for Vyapada. And so it does seem, from what you see from just looking within the Sutta Pitaka, that these two words means having put away the first two hindrances. And if ever you go to the commentaries, the Attakatha, there are two Satipatthana Suttas. There's the Maha Satipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, and there's the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Each one of them has their own commentaries. And in the commentaries, it says that loke abhija means the first hindrance, and domanasa means the second hindrance. And it makes a point that in Pali, whenever there is a very well-known group, mentioning the first two is meant to include all the other members of that well-known group. So if you just mention, say, you know, Rupa Vedana, then it's meant to include all the other five khandhas as well. And so it's actually both commentaries to this sutta. And it seems to be to these suttas. And it seems to make sense. Say that what this means, after putting away worldly greed and grief, means having put aside the five hindrances. And that changes a lot of understanding of what the Satipatthana is. Having put aside the five hindrances. Putting away worldly greed and grief, or what I heard when I first came across Satipatthana, covetousness and greed for the world, never made much sense to me. But when you actually see as it really should be translated, having abandoned the five hindrances, then that makes a huge difference. Any comments? Yes. Yeah.
What's the
reference
without
five verses? I think it's 372. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the one. I haven't got it with me here, but I say that very often, but I think it's 372.
And one more thing. Now, with the Satipatthana, I heard you once say that the
Agama
Satipatthana is shorter than the Pali one.
Yes, we get to that.
Oh, that's later?
Later on, yes. This is in there. This is exactly the same as the Agamas.
So,
exactly, when the hindrances have disappeared. Because otherwise, for you'll know that when you've got the hindrances going, when you're restless, or when you're sort of dull, or when you know got desire or ill will, are you really that mindful? Can you really, really practice that much? So it really does mean you have to have a lot of stillness to be able to do Satipatthana. But you don't have to totally get rid of the hindrances, because then it's like a chicken and egg. To get rid of the hindrances, I've got to be mindful. But I can't get rid of the hindrances until I'm mindful. So it's, you know, which comes first, the mindfulness or getting rid of the hindrances? So it's usual the case they go together, and you just have a bit of mindfulness, and you can weaken the hindrances, gives you more mindfulness, which you can get rid of more hindrances, and they work together. But the reason why he says here, having put away the five hindrances, is because this is the big Satipatthana, for actually entering upon the right path, which is stream winner, and for realizing Nibbana. In other words, this is actually for enlightenment. Yeah.
In the Eightfold Path, now, we shouldn't understand it as this right mindfulness, or let's say perception of non-self or something would help in to get right samadhi. So we shouldn't think of it as one of the factors leading to another, because right samadhi is number 8, but it should go before number 7.
Yeah, they all support one another. So if one is missing, then many others will fall apart. For example, if you know to have wrong speech, if you really had wrong speech, you've lied, or you've said a really rotten thing to someone today, you'll find it so difficult to get decent meditation. So you can see just the effect of bad virtue on the sort of the practice. So all those factors are important. That's the whole point of saying this is the only way. You need all those factors. So now we have the first of the four Satipatthana, the contemplation of the body. And this is the longest one in the Agamas as well. It's usually, I think, the case. Sometimes you wonder when the people writing this down, they got the first one and they put so much in the first one, and they got to the second or the third, that I can't go on like this. So they get shorter and shorter as you go on. But anyway, contemplation of the body. How does the disciple dwell in contemplation of the body? First of all, anapanasati, which is mindfulness of the breath. Herein the disciple retires to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to a solitary place. Okay, this is what we have to do in solitude. This is why we've got monasteries. That's why you escape from your home and your husband for a few months. Because it's much easier when it's a solitary place. And seat yourself with legs crossed, body erect, with mindfulness fixed before them. Now, with mindfulness fixed as a priority, as I say. Because that's a totally different understanding of the, what is it called? It means putting in front. And again, you don't just always watch the breath at the tip of the nose. You don't put it in front. This is actually the Westerner's idea. When I heard, you've got to put the mindfulness in front of you, as a Westerner, I always thought I lived in the head, as a young man. So in front of me meant in here somewhere. This is me. This is putting in front of me. But you should all know that sort of in Asia until very recently, and actually in Europe, 200 or 300 years ago. People thought they lived in their heart, in here. So if you asked a person who was doing Satipatthana and they read this 300 years ago, mindfulness in front of them means they have to be mindful in here somewhere. So this idea of in front of your nose is just obviously wrong. And what it truly means is giving it a priority. A priority means you top of your list, you put it in front. So again, when you understand the Pali, it makes a slightly different meaning and it changes the whole of how you do, I say here, Anapanasati. So you make mindfulness a priority, first of all. So you know, to wake up, present moment awareness and silence. That's, to me, how you develop strong mindfulness. And then, mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. And one of the big problems with mindfulness of the breath is that many people, they go straight on to mindfulness of the breath whenever they sit down. You're not ready for it yet. You haven't got your mindfulness strong enough, which means the only way you can watch the breath is too much force, and you usually lose it anyway, so because you haven't done the preparation. So preparation is important, and that's where you make mindfulness, establishing mindfulness, your priority. And then, you mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. We're making a long inhalation. You know, I make a long inhalation. We're making a long exhalation. No, I make a long exhalation. Short inhalation. A short inhalation, short exhalation, you know, I make a short exhalation. Those are steps 1 and 2 of the 16 Anapanasati steps. Clearly perceiving the entire breath body, I shall breathe in, thus you train yourself. Clearly perceiving the entire breath body, I shall breathe out, thus you train yourself. Calming this bodily function, I shall breathe in, thus you train yourself. Calming this bodily function, I shall breathe out, thus you train yourself. That's number 3 or 4. So, there is sometimes some people still have the understanding that perceiving the entire body means that you perceive the head, the ears, the toes, and your fingers and everything else, which is actually pretty much an impossibility. You can experience a sense of the body, but not the entire body in one moment. And of course, that's not what it means. Entire breath body. There are many bodies, and all the word body means, just like in English, a body of soldiers, in law, a body of evidence. A body does not necessarily mean the physical body in which human beings live. It has other meanings too. And here, it does mean the breath body. It's just the accumulation of a phenomena known as in-breathing and out-breathing. So clearly perceiving the entire breath body literally means from the beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath, the gap between the beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath. So in other words, it's not just seeing it going in and out, it's just seeing the whole of the breath, from the beginning to the end, from the end to the beginning. And once you've done that, then you can calm the whole thing down. You can't train a tiger before you've caught the tiger. So you've got to actually catch the breath, as it were, have the whole breath in mind, and then you can calm it down. And those become the first four steps of Anapanasati. Yeah?
Once it calm down, what is it looking
at? Aha, why does it calm down? What it says is calming it down. Usually it does it by itself when you don't interfere. In exactly what Ajahn Chah said, the only reason why a leaf moves is because there's something blowing, making it move. Its nature is to be still. So if you can actually stop the wind, then the leaf becomes still. What I used to say, and you see me doing this so many times before, you know, how can I keep a cup of water absolutely still? Holding it will never keep it still. You put it down, it becomes still all by itself. So it's moving now, but give it another minute or two and it'll be perfectly still. That's how you calm water down, putting it down and letting go. That's how you calm the breath down, putting it down, letting go. You've all seen me do that before, haven't you? Greg, you know, I keep holding a person, is it moving? I'm going to hold it still. Is it still yet? And it's never still. And then said, how do I keep this still? Put it down, stupid. But when you put it down, it always moves more at first. That's a very lovely part of that simile with a cup of water, keeping the cup still. while the water is still. When you first put it down, it moves more. When you first let go, there'll be more movement in the mind. But just wait. Because you're not interfering, because I'm not holding the cup of water, the water gets more and more still, all by itself. That's how you calm the breath, by leaving it alone, not interfering. If you hold it, it doesn't... Yeah?
That's the same step for the breath arising, isn't it? I mean, you don't do something else to have the breath there in the
first sometimes place. People can come and breathe in. Actually do something. So sometimes, and also the first two steps, breathing in long, breathing out long, short, short. That can be interesting for somebody who just hasn't got much mindfulness yet. So you just make an unnatural breath. But it's not really recommended because it just starts to disturb you. Just know whether it's long or short, that's all. You don't have to do both of them. Either will do. Sometimes it's not long, it's not short. It's sort of in the middle somewhere. And that's not in here, is it? Oh my goodness, what am I going to do? I'm not doing Anapanasati anymore. Of course you are. These are just two possibilities. And many others are also included. So thus you dwell in contemplation of the body. And the Buddha actually said that sometimes, that why is this called contemplation of the body? Because the breath is one body amongst others. That's in the Anapanasati Sutta. I won't read it out here because I think you know all this. So thus you dwell in contemplation of the body, either with regard to your own person or to other persons or to both. In other words, just my breath, same as your breath, same as anybody's breath. It's just breath, that's all. So this is one possibility. And what they haven't got here is, before the next sentence, there should be an or. These are alternatives. You dwell in contemplation of the body, your own body, or another person's body, or to both, or you behold how the body arises, or you behold how it passes away, or you behold the arising and passing away of the body, or you just know there's just a body. So these are alternatives. Not to do all of them, but any one of them is fine. Now when it says how the body arises, many people, you know, get a bit unsure about that. It has a specific meaning, which is in the Satipatthana Sangyutta. I probably won't find it. You can find it yourself. It's in, I think it's, let me see if I can find it for
so
you.
So we can substitute the word body with breath.
Yeah, so it's got here, that's good. The breath body.
Yeah.
The whole sort of group of body. The whole group of, the whole, what you might call it? The whole process of breath or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, see if I can just find the... Where's it gone? That's in the end here. Sometimes the... where are we? Here we go. Satipatthana Sangyutta. Now I've got to just find the index. It's in the arising of the Satipatthana Sangyutta. I've got two indexes here. I should not be too long... It's pretty easy to find. Oops. Oh, there you go. On the origination sequence 60. I think this is the one. Yes. So this is, they say here arising. Here they say origination in the Sangyutta Nikaya. So where it says here, contemplate how the body arises or contemplates how it passes away, this is what it means according to the Buddha. Monks, I will teach you the arising and passing away of the four establishments of mindfulness. Listen to that. And what, monks, is the arising of the body? With the arising of nutriments, there is the arising of the body. With the cessation of nutriments, there's a passing away of the body. So it's actually not actually watching the body sort of get born or pass away. It's actually understanding the causes, where the body comes from. And the nutriments of the body, it is food, it's consciousness, It's will. What's the other one? Contact, yeah. So the four nutriments of the body. And with the arising... Oh, sorry.
That's kama chitta uttarahara.
Sorry?
That's a different grouping, is it?
What, sorry?
Kama chitta uttarahara.
That's right, yeah, that's another one. And with the... what about the arising of vedana, the feeling, the second satipatthana, with the arising of contact. This is contact with the senses. There's the arising of feeling. With the cessation of contact, there's the cessation of feeling. With the arising of nama-rupa, name and form, basically that is understood as the objects of consciousness. With the arising of nama-rupa, there's the arising of mind, of citta. With the cessation of name and form, there's the cessation of citta. And that is actually the arising and passing away of the third satipatthana. Now this is an interesting one here, because they use the word citta here, but in other places they use this, especially depending on which nation, as vijnana. Because, you know, they have this wonderful simile of the two sheaves of reeds. Vijnana and nama-rupa, consciousness, and name and form, and the objects of consciousness, they rest against each other. You take one away, and the other one disappears. And here, actually, they use citta. And it does seem to be, in other places, they use citta and vijnana as synonyms sometimes. And the other thing, which, of course, you mention here, with the origination of nama-rupa, citta arises, with the cessation of nama-rupa, citta ceases. So citta ceases. Mind is not permanent. There's no such thing as an original mind.
What page is that?
This is 1660. It's called origination here. I used to call it arising. It's the same word in Pali, in the Satipatthana Samyutta. And the Dhammas. Now, this is interesting for the Dhammas afterwards, because when we get back to it, to understand what it actually means, this fourth Satipatthana, with the origination of attention, manasikara, there is the arising of Dhamma, the cessation of manasikara, the cessation of Dhamma. So it does almost seem to me like mind objects again, but we'll leave that. But that's actually what it means by arising and passing away of these things. It's not actually just seeing like a feeling come into your body and then disappear again. It's not actually seeing sort of, you know, the beauty there and disappear again. It's not like when you're having your lunch, you know, you can sort of, you can taste sort of the chip and it's gone as soon as it gets in the mouth. It's actually the causes of these things is what the Buddha means over here. It's not so much noticing sort of the experience, but finding out the cause and effect, where these things come from. That's what the Satipatthana wants you to do here. So it's not just seeing it come and go, but understanding why it comes, where it comes from, and why it goes. Yes?
It says clearly perceiving. The other ones are clearly perceiving. This is a contemplation. This is not perceiving. It's the contemplation.
Contemplation, yeah. Good.
It's different than the other directions.
Yeah.
It says he contemplates, but is that, I mean, if he's watching the bird, he's not contemplating another person's breath,
isn't it? No, it's usually, yes, afterwards. So this is where you get your data. I use a simile of a scientist, you do your experiment, and then when you get your data, then you look at it, and you draw your graph, or tabulate it all, and then you get your conclusion. You see, oh, there's something going on there.
From what you said, it's like the deep origin.
Yeah, it's actually the dependent origination, basically. Where do these things come from? Daniel had your hand up first, and Greg comes next. No, I can't really say that. It's just too much difference.
No, like the jhanas, but with the understanding, with the
Dhamma
in mind.
Well, no, not really, no. Satipatthana is you're getting some evidence there. And here you're actually finding out, just in particular case, body, or just the breath, where the breath comes from, the experience of breath, where it comes from, understanding cause and effect, basically. But it meant this particular phrase here, dwells in contemplation of the body out of regard to its own person or to other persons or to both, or behold how the arising factors of the body, I would call it these days, beholds the passing away factors of the body, beholds both the arising and passing away factors of the body, or just knows it's just body, applies to every one of the satipatthanas. But here, you change the body to feeling for the other satipatthana, second, body to mind, body to dumbness. So this is a phrase which applies to everything here. So this is what you do. You get the information here by doing the first four stages of breath meditation, and now this is how you regard that evidence, how you make use of it. It's using it to arise wisdom, insight. So this is actually where you use some of your other faculties, not just perceiving, but understanding, seeing how it all fits together. Seeing relationships, cause and effect. Yes, Greg?
Do you do this, like, after you are done meditating, or do it while you're meditating?
Towards the end is very good. Or even doesn't really matter, because you meditate, and afterwards you sort of contemplate what's been happening. So at the end of the meditation, or afterwards, any of those times. It's also very useful to do walking meditation. And walking meditation, because you're physically more active, the mind can be more active, and that's also a great time to contemplate just what happened. Yes. Correct,
yeah.
It is an illusion of self, but again, your mind will move that particular way because, you know, I call you being brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm.
But we don't, so, like, after meditating, we say, okay, I'm going to make my mind move. And
yeah, that's right. Sometimes you do that, but it's not really you doing that, so it is automatic.
Oh, right, that's
true. Yeah. So what it actually means here, this is one of the most important things, a body is there. It really doesn't actually show the total actually meaning of that. It means just basically just this is the body, it's just the body. It's just like this is body, nothing else. So what they actually say here, which is Vanyan Tilokas' commentary, is pretty good. A body is there, but no living being, no individual, no woman, no man, no self, and nothing that belongs to a self. Neither a person nor anything else belonging to a person. Actually that is from the Atikata, not from Vanyan Tiloka. That's perfect. So this is actually, you can see what you do, you see how you contemplate, and this is the purpose of it. So you know what you're doing if you understand, well, what am I supposed to do it? What's it supposed to be about? You know, what is Satipatthana for? And this is the main thing, to see non-self. It's just a body. Body comes, body goes, the breath comes, the breath goes. You see why it comes, where it comes from, and why it just ceases. So, you know, it's just a body, it's not a permanent thing. And this clear awareness is present in them to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, so you live independent, unattached to anything in the world. In other words, being an arahant. Thus does a disciple dwell in contemplating of the body. Now, where it says this is a lot of... Well, I'm not even going to... Yeah, I suppose I must do. Mindfulness of breathing is one of the most important meditative exercises. This is from Jnana Tiloka. It may be used for the development of tranquility, either for attaining the four absorptions, for the development of insight, or for a combination of both practices. Here, in the context of Satipatthana, it is principally intended for tranquilization and concentration preparatory to the practice of insight, which may be undertaken in the following way. After a certain degree of calm and concentration on one of the absorptions has been attained through regular practice of mindful breathing, the disciple proceeds to examine the origin of the breath. He sees that inhalation and exhalations are conditioned by the body, consisting of the four material elements and the various corporal phenomena derived from them, e.g. the five sense organs. Conditioned by fivefold sense impression arises consciousness, together with the three other groups of existence, feeling, perception, and mental formations. Thus, a meditator sees clearly there is no ego entity or self in his so-called personality, but it is only a corporal mental process conditioned by various factors. Thereupon, he applies the three characteristics, these phenomena, understands them thoroughly as impermanent, subject to suffering, and impersonal. Okay, it's fair enough. It's not that bad. The four postures. Now, this is another of the Satipatthanas. And with each one of these, not including the repetition, sometimes you miss that with the four postures again. You have to dwell, contemplating the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having put away the five hindrances. Then you do four postures. And further, whilst going, standing, sitting, or lying down, the disciples understands, according to reality, the expressions, I go, I stand, I sit, I lie down. He understands any position of the body. Actually, more than that, this is actually, I think, Jnanatiloka. It's nice what he says, but I think it just means you understand these four postures. So you're actually mindful. So when you're actually walking, you know, you're actually there when you're walking, rather than worrying where you're going to go to, or thinking about something different. So the disciple understands there is no living being, no real ego that goes, stands, etc., but it is just a mere figure of speech. So one says, I go, I stand, and so on. And mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, again, this is, again, that you have already be ardent, clearly comprehension, mindful, and you put away the five hindrances. The disciple acts with clear comprehension in coming and going. He acts with clear comprehension in looking forward and backwards, acts with clear comprehension in bending and stretching any part of his body, acts with clear comprehension in carrying arms, bowl and robes, acts with clear comprehension in eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, acts with clear comprehension in discharging excrement and urine, acts with clear comprehension in walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, awakening, acts with clear comprehension in speaking and keeping silent. Now what does that really mean? What it really means is the clear comprehension. It does actually say something which is pretty useful at the bottom there from the commentary. You have clear comprehension of your intention. You know, what's the point of this? Now, why are you on the toilet? Now, why are you walking? Now, why are you carrying your bowl? You know, of the advantage, basically, what you're going to get out of this, the duty of the reality. And basically, you know exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. So it's not just walking, you actually keep in mind the purpose of the walking. However, there is a big mistake in Pali, two big mistakes there in Pali, which I've often pointing out. They have falling asleep and awakening. The actual Pali is very clear. It does not mean falling asleep. It does not mean awakening. It means in sleep and while awake. So not just the act of falling asleep or the act of waking up. It's actually clearly comprehending on sleep. Sute, it means, in Pali here. Falling asleep is nidang okamana. It's a totally different Pali word here. And it's very interesting here that, be careful, if any of you ever translate anything, if it's in from Bahasa Malaysia into English, or into sort of Chinese, into Pali or whatever, you have to translate what's there, and you can't sort of bend it to fit what you think makes sense. Because here, the translator thought, how can you be mindful while you're asleep? We all know that you can't be mindful when you're asleep, but that's actually what the Pali said. So instead of actually writing what the Pali said and saying asleep, they change the word to falling asleep. And there they make big mistakes. It's exactly the same, for those of you who don't know, in the first sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, it's the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the Buddha finishes by saying the monks were not delighted with what the Buddha said. And that's what it says in the Pali, very clear. And when Miss I.B. Horner first translated that, she said, that must be wrong, because, you know, everyone must be delighted with what the Buddha said. And so actually she changed her translation. She did put a note in there and said, there must be some mistake. Oh, there must be... Is that a car coming? No, I don't know. There must be some mistake, she said, because we all know that everybody is always delighted with what the Buddha said. And so she changed the translation. Only later on we realised, because this is well known, the monks weren't delighted because they didn't understand it. But later on the Buddha gave another sutta and they actually became enlightened. So she got it wrong because she misunderstood. Whenever you think you understand what is meant and you put your understanding in there, rather what's there, you usually miss something. And here they miss something. It means being asleep. So how can you be mindful while sleeping? Is that what it means? What's the solution to this conundrum? You know already because you've been there for years. No, you probably know. Don't know because you haven't heard me speak before so much. But Nicholas comes every year, so he knows the same questions, the same answers.
Could be wrong. I think it means that you should be calm and sensible, and if you need to sleep, sleep.
No, the purpose of it, that's very good, yeah.
Oh, I just heard that arahants don't dream, so that's kind of the mindfulness going into the sleep.
Yeah, it doesn't mean into it, it means sort of during the sleep. And what it actually means is the mindfulness is not always on the moment. It's mindfulness of what has happened. So while you're asleep, you're gone. You're unconscious. Even arahants. So, but when you come out afterwards, you're mindful of what you've been doing of its purpose. I've slept enough. It's good enough, so I can get up now. So sometimes a mindfulness takes as its object something which has passed already. Now that needs to be known, because this is why we call contemplation, reflection of what happened. You cannot be contemplating, say, the jhanas. You don't have enough movement of mind to be able to do that. When you emerge afterwards, that's when you contemplate them. And that's where you get the great insights. So mindfulness about what sleep was. And actually that partly it is exactly allowable. It's actually mindfulness, not in sleep, but mindfulness on sleep. On the idea of sleep, on what sleep's all about. But what you also said about what the purpose is.
So that means when the mindfulness is very strong, you can go back and remember your dreams much.
Well, not so much your dreams. You know you were asleep.
Okay.
And you know you spent 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, whatever. You know why you spent it. It was worthwhile. It's very important because sometimes we're not in a monastery to sleep away our life, nor are we in here to try and be ascetic and just to beat the Guinness Book of Records with, you know, how little sleep we can get away with. So what's the purpose of sleep?
Rest the body
and rest the mind. And you know, it's not just to escape, you know, from the sort of suffering of life, nor is it just to sort of indulge. So you know the purpose of sleep, and you can feel it when you feel very healthy, and you just step the right amount, and you feel very sharp and energized. So you know the purpose. That's what it really means there.
I'm trying to split hairs. How can you be
okay, mindfulness, you can actually never be mindful of what's happening in the moment, simply because just by the time it comes to your senses, it's already disappeared. Like watching the sun, it's 8.5 minutes old, what you're actually watching.
Yeah,
and that's,
okay.
Yeah. But you can still get a sort of an image, you know, from the past. You know, can you, yeah, you know that, just what you were doing this morning. Okay, now we go on to another of the body contemplations. And again, having ardent, mindful, comprehending, in other words, you know what you're doing this for. Having put aside the five hindrances, you contemplate the loathsomeness of the body. And further, disciple contemplates this body from the sole of the foot upwards and from the top of the hair downwards, with the skin stretched over it and filled with manifold impurities. This body has hair of the heads, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, stomach, bowels, mesentery, which is like the contents of your stomach, and excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, lymph, tears, skin grease, saliva, nasal mucus, otherwise known as snot, one of the joints in your eye. Just if there were a sack with openings at both ends, filled with various kinds of grain, with paddy, beans, sesame and husk rice. Remember, Royal Society had all ideas of different types of grain. And a man, not blind, opened it, opened the sack and examined its contents. Oh, this is rice, this are beans, this is sesame, this is husk rice. It's just so the disciple investigates his body. And what's that called? The parts of the body? 32 parts? Count them. There's only 31 there. Which one is missing? Your brain, yes. So the commentary realised that they left out the brain, so they had another one, the brain, it's number 32. But in original, it was only 31 parts. Again, because the brain wasn't really important to people. Now, the heart was, this is where they lived. And the brain, that was actually included in marrow, because you know, it's in the middle of the bones.
If it's just looking at, you know, past the body as past the body, why do they add this folded loathsomeness, which is kind of a very...
Aha! That's very good. I think a lot of times that most people, if you see an autopsy, you know, people get disgusted by it. You know, they go to the first operation and sometimes they feel queasy. Even sometimes people have blood. You know, they faint. Now, I still remember just being a kid and we used to have a TV program, black and white TV, a long time ago, and it was like they did operations, medical operations. And I loved looking at it. And my parents and my brother had to leave the room. They couldn't stand it. They were just digging somebody's body and messing around inside. I love that sort of stuff. They all had to leave. And of course, later on, you went to your autopsies, and I give them many stories about the autopsies, about the autopsy room in Sri Rat Hospital, when I went there the very first time, went there early, no one was around. And I had to wait another half an hour before they came in. And as I was sitting down, I noticed that on the windowsill, they had quite high windows, on like a ledge there, there wasn't flowers on there, there was a plate, and on top of the plate was a human head. A real one, not a plastic one, just cut off at the neck, and just standing there, just as like, you know, you put up sort of a statue. And I couldn't believe how gross and gory that was. But there it was, just a human head, just standing on there on a plate, in the autopsy room. Yeah?
You can still go to the...
Oh, Sri Rat one, yeah. In Thailand, you can, yeah. You can't in Australia anymore, though.
But tourists can... I went last year.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It's still got the head there?
It's not the autopsy room. It's basically the museum.
Oh, the museum, yeah.
And it's quite gory.
Yeah, you've got all the little bits and pieces there. Yeah.
So it's talking about like a natural reaction, not to cultivate this idea of pain.
Indeed, yeah. I think so, yeah. It is actually just a natural reaction when you see bits and pieces of the body, unless you're a real doctor, or used to, or you're weird like some monks like me. So a lot of times it's just quite gross.
But he says here the impurities
of the body. Yeah, but I mean, is it really impure?
The intention here is to get away from the beautiful.
That's right. And as I mentioned, that we have, for anyone who becomes a novice, if you're going to ordain, you have to... You were taught when novice ordination of the five parts of the body as your contemplation, which is hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. And for those of you who've been to the ordinations which I've done before, I mentioned the reason why they are separated out from the others is because they are the outside ones. All the other ones are inside. So when you look at a body, that's what you see: hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. So that's what you see when you look. And we also know, as I keep on saying, that the hair which you see is dead. The live part is invisible, it's underneath. The same with the teeth. We look at someone's teeth, that's all dead, enamel on the outside. The roots are deep inside. And the nails, dead stuff. And skin is also dead. The live part of the skin is a millimeter or two under the surface. So whenever you do this contemplation, you see somebody, all you see is dead hair, dead nails, dead skin, dead teeth. You just see a dead person. So why would you want to kiss them, to stroke the dead hair, or to hug them and see their dead teeth? It's all dead stuff.
Like, why are you laughing? This is true, isn't it? Just a bit gross, that's why. Yes, dead Nicholas. That's why I see you anyway. Right up suddenly.
There's some sort of a thing that's recited, and often you encourage the softening of a term like the disgustingness of the body.
Yeah.
Is that so that to protect people from developing like the new will to the body? And
indeed.
Hating it?
And negativity. It's also that you see, like with ascetics, and there is an ascetic tradition in Buddhism, and sometimes you can take their asceticism just to, what's it called, quite sort of psychotic states, and it's just really sort of dangerous. So it's true, mate. You see it just as, loathsome is not really the right word, but just, what's a good word again?
Repulsive,
that's actually the word I use. Repulsive just means it pushes you away from really wanting to get involved in the body too much.
Or maybe perception of it's changed.
That's right, you just basically, you're not really too interested in it. You know exactly what it is, and this is what it is, and you just bear with it, but you don't delight in it.
Within one's own makeup, is it just a matter of being aware that you're aware of whether you're going too far because of sort of staying too negative to the perception of life and this sort of thing? That's a sign.
That's right. The whole purpose of it is to know it's just a body. So, again, what I mentioned with the first of the Satipatthanas here, the breath, applies to each one of these. When you know the purpose of it, to know just, you see where it comes from, where it goes to, it's just a body, not me, not mine, not a self. We know its purpose. Then if it's fulfilling that purpose, you know, it's just a body, you're not really sort of hung up on it either way with disgust or with cherishing it, it's done its job.
Because, often I've heard you in talks, you know, to love this moment because this moment is you, sort of thing. In the sense that there has to be that, it seems like there has to be a balance to sort of soften your will.
Indeed, yeah.
By also including and embracing.
Yeah. But in a sense of loving this moment means you have to sort of let go of other things. Now this is just so you let go of everything to do with this body, so it frees you. When you understand just how much effort and time most people spend on this body, you understand why, that by doing this contemplation, you free yourself from so many concerns.
So it generates a certain happiness?
Happiness of freedom. You don't have to worry about your hairstyle, about just what your skin looks like, and whether your teeth are straight. So you don't have to worry about all that sort of stuff anymore. So you can be...
The apartment store, the first floor, is perfumes and makeup.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
So in our world, this is a good antidote.
Yeah. Indeed it is. So I have to keep going on because there's much more to do. The analysis of the four elements. Again, having mindful, having put aside the five hindrances, you contemplate this body, however it may stand or move in regard to the elements. This body consists of solid element, liquid element, heating element, vibrating element, just as if a skilled butcher or butcher's apprentice who has slaughtered a cow and divided it into separate portions was to sit down at the junction of four high roads. Just so the disciple contemplates his body with regard to the four elements. It says here, when a butcher rears a cow, brings it to the place of slaughter, and binds it to a post and makes it stand up, and slaughters and looks at the slaughtered cow, during all that time he has still the notion cow. But when he has cut up the slaughtered cow, divided it to a piece, and sits down near it to sell the meat, the notion cow ceases in his mind, and the notion meat arises. He does not think that he is selling a cow, that people buy a cow, but that it is meat that is sold and bought. Similarly, an ignorant worldling, whether a monk or layman, the concept of being, man, personality, etc., will not cease until he has mentally dissected this body of his as it stands and moves and has contemplated according to its component elements. But when he has done so, the notion of personality will disappear and his mind will become firmly established in the contemplation of the elements. It's a good point. You know, we never eat pig. We never eat sort of cow. We eat steak. We eat sort of pork. You know, we give it a different name. So afterwards you see that it's not Nicholas. You don't call it Nicholas anymore. You just call it five khandhas or six sense bases or the four elements. Yes, four elements.
If one's using, say, the breath body instead of the physical. Well, the breath body is really the sensation of breath, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're using that sensation rather than, say, the material body, does one get the same liberating insights?
Different insights for different things. But I often say one of the great functions is just to know it's just a body, that's all. And you know you've done that when you can let the body go. So one of the great functions, meanings, purposes of body contemplation is to let this body disappear. And you know you've actually completed the body contemplation when you can sit here and the body vanishes.
Because when meditation is often taught, it's often taught as breath, but there's not a lot said about body contemplation, but is it just a process that naturally will come to people?
Yeah, it usually comes to people because we spend so much time looking at the body, we know we're actually going to turn that body attention to something more useful. Instead of something worrying about our body and seeing how old we are and how we can hide that and how we can get dye for our hair, how we can sort of pick out sort of the hairs in the wrong places in our ears or whatever, we can actually just see this body for what it is. And we know we've done it right. If we've gone too ascetic, again, the body doesn't disappear. But if you just do it in the middle way, then the body can sit here and the body doesn't bother you at all.
Did you realize that it's not often taught in
what?
Body contemplation, like in the lay venues, like
Nalamala? Well, I don't know, because a lot of time people who go to Nalamala, they just want to lessen their suffering. They don't want to escape from suffering. No. Indeed, it's like a buffet. Yeah. It's like a buffet, whichever one you like. So you don't have to eat all of the food at lunchtime. Otherwise you get sick. You take a bit from here, pass over a couple of them, take something else. Cemetery meditations. And further, just as if the disciple looking at a corpse right on a charnel ground, one, two or three days dead, swollen up, blue, black in colour, full of corruption, so he regards his own body. This body of mind also has its nature, has its destiny, and cannot escape from it. And further, just as the disciple looking at a corpse right on a charnel ground eaten by crows, hawks or vultures, by dogs or jackals, or devoured by all kinds of worms, so he regards his own body. This body of mind also has its nature, has its destiny, cannot escape it. And further, just as the disciple were looking at a corpse thrown on a charnel ground, a framework of bones, flesh hanging from it, bespattered with blood, held together by sinews. Or even later, a framework of bones, stripped of flesh, bespattered with blood, held together by sinews. Or later, a framework of bone without flesh and blood, but still held together by the sinews. Or even later, bones disconnected and scattered in all directions. Here a bone of the hand, a bone of the foot, a shin bone, a thigh bone, a pelvis, there the spine, there the skull. So he regards his own body, these bones and bones, This body of mind also has its nature, has its destiny, and cannot escape it. And further, just as if the disciple looking at bones lying on the charnel ground, bleached and resembling shells, or bones heaped together after the lapse of years, or bones weathered and crumbled to dust, so he regard his own body. This body of mind also has its nature, has its destiny, and cannot escape it. Thus he dwells in contemplation of the body, either in regard to his own person or to other persons, just a bunch of bones. Or to both, he beholds how the body arises, how it passes away. Beholds the arising and passing away of the body, and just a body, that's all. This clear awareness is present in them to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, and he live independent, unattached to anything in the world. Thus does the disciple dwell in contemplation of the body. So in those days, you could actually go to charnel grounds and see sort of body just thrown away. Unfortunately, due to occupational health and safety, we can't do that these days. So, it's very rare to see a dead body. And even if you see one in the funeral parlor, by the time you get to it, they have been to the embalmer. Which means that, you're always smiling. And there's that story of this woman who said, I don't think it was one of the funerals I did. He said, that's amazing, because he never smiled in his life. Because they assume they would have made it lost. So they just put this all together just so they don't have to see these things with the body. But nevertheless, now and again, that you can go and see one of the kangaroos in this monastery, because the kangaroos sometimes get hit by the car, and you can actually see this whole process happening over the days and months, and you're just the same.
Yeah.
They actually go and pick the bones after cremation. That's right, yeah. That's very common in Thailand as well. Yeah. So but that's just, that's, you know, they've been burned, so they're quite nice.
Yeah.
And of course, Eddie, you've got a whole heap of bones, you know, in your room there, so he's in the room with all the bones in there.
Graham.
Oh, Graham's in there. Okay. That's right, yeah, sorry. He's in the bone room. Sorry, Eddie, yeah. I think an Asian would like to be in there. Yeah. No, you don't. No, it's really? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, oh, they're great kids. I've got a bigger one than you have. Yes. No, they're all dead by then. They're all burnt. That's right. You look after it, but you don't attach to it. And it's amazing how many people attach to their body, and you see that when they're told they've got cancer. And they think, I'm going to die. They really sort of go over the top. Yeah. As you, so others. And just say you are assured of 10 blessings. Once the contemplation of the body is practiced, developed, often repeated, has become one's habit, one's foundation, is firmly established, strengthened, and perfected, the disciple may expect 10 blessings. Over delight and discontent you have mastery. You do not allow yourself to be overcome by discontent. You subdue it and soon it arises. So especially delight and discontent in material things. There's nice food, lots of nice food. You feel sick, you feel healthy. Oh, it's just part of the body. You conquer fear and anxiety. Not allow yourself to be overcome by fear and anxiety. You subdue them as soon as they arise, especially the fear of illness and the anxiety about your demise. And you can endure cold and heat, hunger and thirst, wind and sun, attacks by gadflies, mosquitoes and reptiles. Patiently you can endure wicked and malicious speech, as well as bodily pains that befall you, though they may be piercing, sharp, bitter, unpleasant, disagreeable, and dangerous to life. It's just the body, that's all doing its thing. And also the four absorptions which purify the mind and bestow happiness even here. These you may enjoy at will, without difficulty, without effort. This is because you're not attached to the body, you just let it go. And that's what happens. The giant's what happens when the body disappears. The six, I'll go to the end first of all. Six, psychic powers. And you may also enjoy the different magical powers. Actually, they don't actually say what the magical powers are. They just go on to the heavenly ears. The magical powers are things like flying through the air, like passing through walls, like walking on water. That's number 605 over there. They do all those sorts of stuff. With the heavenly ear, the purified superhuman, you may hear both kinds of sound, the heavenly and the earthly, distant and near. As I mentioned, that when I first went to Wat Pa Phong, there was one of the monks there who developed that, and you could hear sounds from a long way away. With the mind, you may attain insight into the hearts of other beings. In other words, you can read other people's minds and know what you're really thinking right now. Or you may obtain remembrance of your previous lives. Or with the heavenly eye, purified and superior, you may see beings vanish and reappear. The base, the noble, beautiful, and likely, the happy, and the unfortunate, you may perceive how beings are reborn according to their karma. Or you may, through the cessation of the asavas, come to know for yourself, even this life, the stainless deliverance of mind, the deliverance through wisdom. The last six blessings are the psychic powers. The first five of them are the mundane, lokiya conditions, and may therefore be attained even by a worldling, while the last psychic power is a supermundane, exclusive of the characteristics of the Arahant. It is only after the attainment of all the four absorptions that may fully succeed in acquiring the five worldly psychic powers. These are the four Dipatata, blah, blah, blah. But actually, that's not true. Sometimes people without the four jhanas can still have some of those. But they say that the only psychic power the Buddha praised is actually, no, it's actually, that's another one I was talking about. What's the only psychic power the Buddha praised? Teaching Dhamma, yes. So if someone says, Ajahn Brahm, you've got psychic powers, sometimes you say, yes. Can you show me one? Sit down and I'll teach you a Dhamma discourse. That's not what I want.
Why is that a psychic power?
It's because it actually has huge effect over people. Yeah.
Ajahn, when it says contemplation of the body's practice, what does that mean? Does that mean just one of these?
You really get into it.
Can it be anyone? So,
it can be any one of those, but to the point where you realise it's just a body, you can let it go, and you develop sort of some of these jhanas, because this is what happens. When you let go of the body, you contemplate it, it vanishes, you're not holding on to it anymore. You know you've let it go when it disappears. That's a sign of disappearing.
And then when it says you conquer fear and anxiety, he subdues it. Is that the mindfulness that sees the arising of those states?
When the mindfulness sees the arising, or rather wisdom understands where it comes from, where it goes to, it realizes, does it belong to me? Basically, it's none of my business. So why am I afraid of what's going to happen to somebody else?
Fear of death.
It's not me dying. Well, what's the big problem? Why be anxious when it's not me who's going?
So it sort of stops the mental proliferation.
It takes the identification of this body with you. So when you own something, fear is when what you own is going to be taken away from you. If you don't own it, where's the fear? Yes.
So you can just do the analysis of the four elements enough and you can get to the thing.
If you do it properly, but you've got to do it full on, 100%. That's the difficulty. That's why most people do a bit of this and a bit of that. So just, you know, like a rice and maybe just a few beans is enough to live by. But can you do that? No, because you know all the other nice food is there. So you've got a buffet here, so have a bit of this, a bit of that. And that gives you a bit of variety in the contemplation of the body. But you don't know the whole purpose of it, is to realize that it's just body, it doesn't belong to me. None of my business. Just rent it. Yes?
You mentioned those two psychic powers just a second. You mentioned before those two psychic powers. You briefly mentioned it, but I caught it.
I don't think it's it. What do you mean? About the psychic powers here, yeah. I think it was diving, walking on water, diving through the walls. Oh, no, the one which is praise, yeah, the only psychic powers is praise, which is the teaching Dhamma, all the other psychic powers, no. Yep. So, now that's the first of the Satipatthanas. Now there's three others. Fortunately, the other ones are not as long. So how does the disciple dwell in contemplation of Vedana? Again, Vedana is a quality of pleasure and pain, or pain, or in between, associated with every one of the six senses. And so again, the first preamble goes in there, mindful, ardent, fully aware, having put aside the five hindrances, you dwell in contemplation of the feelings. Experience of Vedana, you know I have an agreeable feeling, I have a disagreeable feeling, or I have an indifferent feeling. In other words, in between. You have a worldly agreeable feeling, an unworldly agreeable feeling, or have a worldly disagreeable feeling. Or an unworldly disagreeable feeling, a worldly indifferent feeling, or have an unworldly indifferent feeling. So these are niramisa and amisa. Basically it means there's something there to do with some sort of attachment or worldly stuff. So you can see there, a worldly agreeable, unworldly agreeable, worldly, unworldly, worldly, unworldly, indifferent feeling. Yes, you had a question there.
With breath meditation, sensation of the breath, is it mixed up with pleasant or neutral or painful feeling?
Of course it is, yes. That's why later on we get things like the 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th factors of Anapanasati. In the Anapanasati Sutta are contemplation of feelings, because having calmed the breath down, then one experiences pity, one experiences sukha, one experiences the whole citta sankhara, one calms that citta sankhara, which is the vedana. The pity and the sukha are the vedana associated with the breath, which is forms the main focus of the meditation of that particular stage, and the Buddha says it fits into the vedana upasana.
When is physical sensation, just like, say, the feeling of the sensation of the breath, when is that feeling?
Remember, the five khandhas are sometimes, they overlap. So it really depends on what particular aspects of that experience you're focusing on. Whether it's the bodily aspect of the breath, the physical air going in, you know that through the feeling, but the main perception is the breath. Now you know the breath is breath going in, breath going out. You know it as a feeling, but it's a breath. And later on, instead of just breath going in, breath going out, the delight, the beauty in the breath is what forms a major part of your perception. So that's why it falls into the second Satipatthana.
So with that perception, there might still be a sensation that's pleasant or neutral.
Of course, yeah.
But it's secondary?
Secondary, good, yeah.
So is tone or mood a good translation of that?
There is no real tone or mood. It really just, there is no English word which I found is, okay, you can use across all the six senses. Thus you dwell in contemplation of Vedana, as regard to your own person or to other persons, as I feel, so other people feel, or to both. Or, behold how Vedana arises, and I mentioned, where does Vedana come from? How does it arise?
Contact,
yes. When contact goes, that's how it ceases. So behold the rise, the passing away of Vedana, you behold the rising and passing away of Vedana, you just know that it's just feelings. And that clear awareness is present in you to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness. You live independent, unattached to anything in the world. Thus the disciple dwells in the contemplation of Vedana. Disciple understands the expression, I feel has no validity, accepts the convention of expression. He understands in the absolute sense, there are only feelings and there is no ego, no experience of the feelings. But more than that, always understand that these feelings are just go according to contact. And you just can't always have agreeable feelings. You have to have disagreeable feelings. There's no way, even, who is it, Roosevelt said, you can please all of the senses some of the time, some of the senses all the time, you can't please all the senses all the time. Or something like that. So you can understand that these are just feelings, and trying to just pleasant feelings is a total waste of time, and just if you understand that much, it just really, really sort of shows very, very clearly all these religions which want to go to heaven afterwards are just wasting their time totally. There is no such thing as an eternally pleasant heaven. Cannot be. Yes? Yeah.
And you also said that Vedana arises because of contact.
Yeah.
And contact disappears and Vedana disappears.
Yes.
And you said in your talks, a couple of Wednesday evening talks, in the third jhana, that Piti disappears.
Yeah.
So what contact has disappeared then?
It's an interesting question. It is a mental contact to that object. So the piti, where is it coming from? The piti would be coming from the absence of, especially the body. That's the sukha as well. So piti is, where is it actually coming from, that tougher joy, tighter joy? No, but it's, remember that's an object. In that particular state,
pity is one of your objects of meditation. So, and the mind turns away from it. And so it disappears. Yes. No, it's all mental object. A mental object, but the mind contacts it. It's mind consciousness, pity is its object, the two coming together. There's a contact there. And when they sort of separate, it vanishes.
Because the other one is more powerful?
Yeah, the sukha is more powerful, more delicious. So the mind just turns to that which is nicer. That's a tough question. But anyway, so that's contemplation of Vedana. Now we have the contemplation of Jitta. How does a disciple dwell in the contemplation of the Jitta? Herein, the disciple knows the greedy mind is greedy. The not greedy mind is not greedy. He knows that hating mind is hating. The not hating mind is not hating. He knows the deluded mind is deluded. And the undeluded mind is undeluded. He knows the crap mind is crapped. The scattered mind is scattered. The developed mind is developed. The undeveloped mind is undeveloped. Surpassable mind is surpassed. The unsurpassable mind is unsurpassable. Knows the concentrated mind is concentrated, the unconcentrated mind is unconcentrated. Knows the free mind is freed, the unfreed mind is unfreed. Now what it means actually here is greedy mind, that's greed, hate and delusion, lobha, dosa, moha, the three hindrances. How can you know the deluded mind is deluded? Sounds weird to me. If you're deluded, you're deluded. Yeah. So how can you know the deluded mind? Because most people who are deluded think they're undeluded.
You might see that something's missing after it's disappeared.
Well, sometimes when I'm deluded. That's the thing. There's, people say that, you know, the only way to overcome madness is actually to know I'm mad. That's the first step. If you don't know you're mad, then there's no way out. You can't, it's delusion, that's what it's like.
This is maybe after you
have... Exactly. That whole thing about the contemplation is I was deluded. Mm-hmm. But you can't really know it at the time.
And you can't actually have that greed there because like the five hindrances are gone.
Indeed,
it's always
yeah.
what's first.
Yeah. Indeed.
So it's kind of when they're starting to arise again or you're looking back?
You're looking back.
Okay.
I was really greedy. Of course you have a degree of mindfulness. You know you're sort of greedy, you know you're hating, but really, when you really get into it, you know, you don't really realise what you're doing. The mindfulness is so, so weak. And you've got no real clear comprehension the way you get stuck in these things. So a lot of time it's the mindfulness after the event.
These are just people who already have made some progress. So they have...
No, it says anybody. It says anybody. This one here.
Anyone?
Yeah.
But it says after you get finished with the confidence and all that,
oh yeah, and that means you're not so Aryan, but you just suppress
yeah,
it for a while.
You're a learner.
Oh no. This is actually only having put them aside for the time being. No, just you've got into an upachara state at least.
Okay. What's an upachara state?
That means just on the edge of jhanas, 5 minutes is gone. Here we go to this one. So crab mind. This is the mind which is it's a very good definition here. It's very, very clear. It is a mind which is under the third hindrance, sloth and torpor. They call it a crab mind. It's a very nice description. And it does actually mean cramped, small. I think it's sankhita mind, if I remember correctly. And the scattered mind, wikita, which is the restless mind. So again, I suppose we're having a band of 5 hindrances, and these ones particularly mean the hindrance of... sloth and torpor, and the hindrance of restlessness.
Is the metaphor of the prison?
Yeah, indeed, yeah. So that's actually a nice one, because that's what it feels like. You know, you just can't do anything. You're just in this dull hole. And scattered is obviously, I understand why that's a very good word for restlessness. And the next ones, the developed mind and the undeveloped, surpassable, unsurpassable, the concentrated is concentrated, the freed and the unfreed, they are all similes for one thing, non-jhana and jhana.
And that's actually explained very clearly. So citta mind here is a collective term for the cittas or moments of consciousness. Citta being identical with vijnana or consciousness should not be translated by thought. Thought and thinking correspond rather to the verbal operations of the mind, which belong to Sankhara Kanda. Thus he dwells in contemplation of the mind, either with regard to his own person, or to other persons, or to both. My citta, your citta, just the same sort of thing. He beholds how citta arises, beholds how it passes away, or beholds the arising away of citta. Where does citta come from? What's the arising of citta? The object, nama rupa. Where there's nama rupa, then citta arises. The cessation of nama rupa, the cessation of citta. So, or you just know, it's just citta, that's all. This clear awareness is present in you to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, and you live independent, unattached to anything in this world. Thus the disciple dwells in contemplating the citta. That's how we do citta. So you can actually see here that it takes a lot to actually to have a mind which is known greedy, and you know it was greedy before. It was hating, and that's not hating before. It's not deluded. That it's not got the two hindrances of sloth and torpor or restlessness. And it's, you know, the jhana mind, and the mind without jhana. You know, it's just jitta, that's all. Contemplation, and you know, see now how it rises and passes away. Contemplation of mind objects, dhamma.
Sorry,
yeah?
We can find the four hindrances. Where is the fifth one gone?
Ah, doubt.
Yes.
There it is. You just found it. No, it's not in there.
Is there
you might call it the deluded mind.
Okay.
Maybe. But it's not in there. Contemplation of the mind objects, the dhammas. How does the disciple dwell in contemplation of the mind objects? Again, ardent, mindful, and clearly comprehending, having put aside the five hindrances. You dwell in contemplation, first of all, of the mind objects, namely the five hindrances and the awareness. So, you know when there is lust, karma chanda, in you. In me there is lust. You know when there is anger, when there is vayapada in you. In me there is anger. You know when there is sloth and torpor. In me there is sloth and torpor. When there is restlessness and worry, you know there is restlessness and worry. In me there is restlessness and worry. You know when there are doubts. In me there are doubts. You know when these hindrances are not in you, and these hindrances are not in me. You know how they come to arise, how once arisen they are overcome, and you also know how they do not arise again in the future. Now, there's a problem here, because having put aside the five hindrances, having put aside, for example, the first hindrance, you know there is the first hindrance in me. And this is a very, very clear case. When you actually translate that term, lokaya bija, as the first hindrance, which is perfectly obvious, there is obviously a case here that you translate it this way, having put aside the first hindrance, you know there's a first hindrance in me. It makes it very, very clear that a lot of these contemplations are done after the effect. And you've even got a word for it in Pali, pacha vekana jnana, which means you contemplate things once they have gone. Because it's very hard to know when you've got lust, there's lust. You sort of know, but it's only sort of a very unclear knowing. Same when you're anger, and obviously sloth and torpor. You know, you know you've got sloth and torpor, but you don't know it fully. If you really did know it fully, it'd be very easy to overcome. Restlessness and worry and doubts.
Sorry, Bhante, I don't really understand the difference between five entrances here versus in the previous in Chittanupassana. Other than, are you contemplating it more in terms of will and doing?
That's a very good question here, because here these are mind objects. Remember, when it says the arising of these, the arising is attention. So actually, what you're actually doing, you're attending to these things as like an object of the mind, rather than sort of knowing it as an aspect of the mind. So the first one, you're seeing consciousness as almost the screen on which these places are. You know the screen has delusion, the screen has sloth and torpor. the screen sort of has this program on it, the TV screen, it has another program on it. And here, rather than sort of your main perception of the screen, the objects on the screen is your main object in the Dhamma Anupassana. So if citta is like this, the TV screen, the Dhamma are the programs on the screen. Does that make any sense? Okay. If citta is a TV screen and the Dhamma are the programs on that screen, channel 1, channel 2, whatever it is, yeah, programs.
Yeah, sorry, it isn't like in terms of the doer and the intention in citta, no? Because, that is such a strong aspect of citta, no?
Indeed it is. But actually the doer, really, you can't really say it is really put in here, except as maybe an object of consciousness, which will be under the fourth, the contemplation of mind objects. It is also why, I think it comes up later, it comes up on the bottom of this page, you got trying to work these four foundations of mindfulness together with the five khandhas. And say, yeah, the first one, the body, the second one, feeling, the third, citta, that's vijnana. And you've got the last two, sankhara and perception. They try and fit those two into this fourth contemplation. But really that's a bit sort of squeezing things into a place where they don't belong. So contemplation of the mind objects, what they say here is pretty good. It's mind objects, because these mind objects, they arise with attention. You pay attention to what I'm saying, and the mind object comes up. You take your attention away, it disappears. So the reason is these mind objects, to see all these mind objects, these dhammas which exist in the mind, where do they come from? You pay attention to them and there they come. You take your attention away, attention vanishes, the mind object goes.
So you really
can you feel the cold right now?
When you say cold?
Yeah, now you pay attention to it. So when you take the attention away, you can't feel it anymore.
So you know the reason why you sloth, why the sloth and torpor?
Well, it's an interesting one here. Why they put the five hindrances in here? It seems that these are very good things to pay attention to.
But you know the cause for that.
The cause, yeah. You also know the cause, where it comes from.
You kind of can't stop.
You can actually get some sort of... Yeah, steer away from it. Good. This is actually what they say here in this little commentary. For example, lust arises through unwise thinking on the agreeable and light and delightful. You put your attention on the wrong thing. It may be suppressed by the following six methods. Fixing the mind upon an idea that arises disgust, paying attention to something else. Such as I was saying, just, the hair is all dead stuff and stuff. Or controlling one's six senses, in other words, turning away. So not paying attention at all, not paying attention to something else, but not paying attention to anything out there. Moderation in eating, friendship with wise and good people, right instruction. Lust and anger are forever extinguished upon attaining anagami, restlessness extinguished by reaching arahatship, mental worry by reaching sotapannaship. No way! Mental worry is also for the anagami. That's a mistake there. And the Dhudra at the bottom here, the five groups of existence, and further disciple dwells in contemplation of the mind objects, namely of the five khandhas. He knows what corporality is, how it arises, how it passes away, where body comes from, what feeling is, how it arises, how it passes away, what perception is, how it arises and passes away. Understands what mental formations are, how they arise, how they pass away, what consciousness is, how they arise and pass away. Or the six sense bases. Further disciple dwells in contemplation of the mind objects known as the six subjective objective sense bases. He knows the eye and visual objects, the ear and sounds, nose and odors, tongue and taste, body and body impressions, mind and mind objects, and the fetter that arises in dependence of them. He also knows the lust with them, or the desire. He knows how the fetter comes to arise, how the fetter is overcome, and how the abandoned fetter does not arise again. Or the seven enlightenment factors, or the four noble truths. And I mention here that in the earliest version of the Satipatthana, they don't have the five groups of existence, or the sense bases, or the four noble truths. All they have is just the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. And that actually makes a lot more sense, because the hindrances are the negative side and the enlightenment factors are the positive side of the mind object. So the five hindrances are the ones, you know, the bad guys, and the enlightenment factors are the good guys. So you're supposed to get rid of the bad guys and establish the good guys as your mental objects by paying attention to the seven enlightenment factors and taking attention away from the five niwaranas. So it does seem to be these things, it's not against the Dharma, but they weren't really there in the beginning. And they do take a lot of the beauty of the Satipatthana away by making this last Satipatthana a bit too complex.
So I don't think the five hindrances were in, but the five groups of the distance were in?
That's right, yes. Just five hindrances and seven bojangas. So let's do the seven bojangas in a bit more detail. And further, having abandoned all these bad qualities, again, of the five hindrances, and mindful, fully aware, and ardent, disciple dwells in contemplation of the mind objects, namely the seven elements of enlightenment. He knows when there are in them mindfulness, investigation of the Dhamma, energy, got here enthusiasm, pity, you know what pity is, joy, tranquility, stillness, equanimity. He knows when they're not in him, know their arisal and their passing away. What's the cause of these things and how they, when the cause disappears, that these things disappear. And you know it's just mind objects, that's all. They don't actually say here because they do, okay, I'll just go over to page 73. Just with the enlightenment factors, sense bases, the five hindrances, you dwell in contemplation of the mind objects, either regard to your own person, my hindrances, my enlightenment factors, their enlightenment factors, exactly the same, or to other persons, or both. Behold how the mind objects arise with attention to these things, how they pass away, behold the arising and passing away, or you just know they're just mind objects, that's all, they're just hindrances, they're just enlightenment factors. They're not my enlightenment factors. They're not my hindrances. As a goal for you to attain and hang on your chest like a medal. And it also takes away the guilt when you get a hindrance. Oh, I've been a monk for so many years and I still fall asleep when I meditate. No, I don't. It's just the mind falls asleep, not me. So it's just mind objects, that's all. Oh, what a great relief. And that awareness is present in you just the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, so you live independent, unattached to anything in the world. Thus the disciple dwells in contemplation of the mind objects. And that's with the Pojangas. And also, it's with the Four Noble Truths. And further, the disciple dwells in contemplation of the mind objects, namely of the Four Noble Truths. You know, according to reality, what suffering is, origin of suffering, the extinction of suffering, and what the path of least extinction of suffering is. So thus you dwell in contemplation of mind objects, either regard to your own person or to other persons or to both, behold how the mind objects arise or behold where they go away from attention, behold their rising and passing away. Mind objects are just mind objects, that's all. This clear awareness present in you to the extent necessary for knowledge and mindfulness, so you live independent, unattached to anything in the world. Thus the disciple dwelt in contemplation of the mind objects. Now one of the reasons we think they put all these other ones in afterwards is because the mind objects is just the content of a good practitioner's mind. And they say, what type of things are supposed to be in your mind if you're a good practitioner? You're not supposed to be thinking about sort of the football or the food. You know, what you're supposed to be contemplating anyway is hindrances, sense bases, khandhas, enlightenment factors, Four Noble Truths, because this is what is really supposed to be in the monk's mind. They say this is actually examples of mind objects. You put an example of mind object as, say, you know, your next plane trip over to Malaysia. Yeah, that, you know, that is a mind object, you know, for somebody, for me later on.
So, but you know, that's not sort of the sort of thing which the Buddha would put in here. These are examples, the sort of mind objects which a mind is supposed to be thinking of. Therefore, they're examples as this mind object Satipatthana.
Could you say that Dharma?
In this particular one, it means even with a small d, it means the objects of the mind. Remember, just a mind sense base has dharmas as its objects.
But these are really dharmas.
Yeah, because these are examples, because they're supposed to be, this is the sort of dharmas which a monk should be thinking about. But they're only examples.
So it could be any object.
Any object, yes. Which is why attention is where they arise from. Take away attention, they disappear. So that is actually that fourth Satipatthana. Yeah. Yes.
And so we can ignore the rest.
Just yeah. That's right, yeah. So it doesn't actually just... it doesn't take too much away. It just complicates it a little bit more.
And with the word attention, now, just it seems that, just my understanding, the word attention is not actually an aspect of mind or in the kanda. It's just kind of, we're just calling something attention when there is consciousness in a mind object, right? We're just calling this attention. There's no actually attention that's an aspect.
It is, yeah. They call it Manasikara.
It's
one of the Nama Rupas.
Sorry,
Manasikara. Yeah. Yes, work of the mind. It's also translated as attention. In other words, the mind makes this happen, goes towards it.
But you mentioned that in the context of
Yonisa Manasikara. Yeah. That's why that's Yonisa Manasikara, yeah. My mind is working to listen to you. So then your question is in my mind as a Dhamma. If I totally ignored you, your question would vanish. It would not appear in my mind.
But that just happens in cause and effect.
Indeed, yeah. So Manasikara has its cause as well.
So the word attention in Manasikara is just something that we're labeling
Indeed. So show these dharmas don't exist in and of themselves. They come about because of a cause. So all the mind objects, when you take away that sort of cause, they disappear, which is what happens especially in deep meditation. Because your mind just is cleansed of all these mind objects. So you've got hardly anything in there at all. Until there's nothing left in there, no mind objects, and then no mind. That's cessation. Yeah, it's a good word.
But it's not actually anything, just...
just part of the process, yeah.
Sorry, coming back to your analogy about Dhammapassana as the characters in the show,
yeah.
Then you might say that some of this is like Nama Rupa is enjoying the four elements, and then the Sukha at the knowledge of this and so forth.
You can say that, yeah.
But it's quite abstract, kind of...
very abstract.
Kind of.
But this is...
And with a deep understanding that it is just this Nama Rupa, that it's just eating the four elements.
Indeed. And it's a purpose, again, another purpose which I add towards this, is that why did the Buddha call these four Satipatthanas and not have a fifth, and not, you know, say like a Sankhara or like a Dua in here? And I think that one of the reasons is because these are places where people find the self. Just like in the five khandhas, but this is another place, in the body, in Vedana. This is where you attach to. You attach to your body, you attach to your feelings, you attach to this idea of a chitta or mind, or you attach to the objects of your mind. Your insights, you know, your experiences, you know, this is the objects of your mind, which you attach to, create a self out of, and cause more suffering for yourself. So by sort of putting the medicine of attention or mindfulness on these four areas, it's a good way of overcoming the sickness. Okay, just finishing off here. The only way, and again, it's not only way, again, they're just same old sort of error here. The direct way that leads to the attainment of purity, the overcoming of sorrow, lamentation, to the end of pain and grief, the entering upon the right path, realization of nirvana is by these four satipatthanas. These four contemplations of satipatthana relate to all the five groups of existence. This is the pushing it a bit. The contemplation of corporeality relates to rupa kanda, the first kanda, feeling to vedana, obviously, contemplation of mind to vijnana, and contemplation of mind objects to sanya and sankara. For further details about satipatthana, a commentary to this discourse, namely translating the way of mindfulness by Bhikkhu Soma. I read that when I was a student, and I thought it was very funny, because if you read the whole Satipatthana Sutta, it says if you practice it in a proper way, it says you become either an anagami, non-returner, or an arahat within 7 days. And this Bhikkhu Soma said that he travelled to Burma to do this, and he was disappointed he'd been doing it for 2 weeks, and he wasn't an anagami yet. So he said, well, you know, it's obviously something is wrong there, but at least I can translate it into English instead of trying to do any more. And so it was almost, instead of actually carrying on with it, he just decided to do a translation. Anyway, so that is the Satipatthana. When actually the next part, Nibbana-dhyana-panasati, this is actually Anapanasati Sutta. So this is actually much better to actually to do next time. And also we go into a bit more detail about the Bojangas, the seven enlightenment factors, which are either what it's like to be enlightened or the cause of enlightenment. And that's a very nice thing to do separately. So I'm going to finish over there because that really is the end of right mindfulness. And this last factor is of Anapanasati and the enlightenment factors. They actually really fit more with the last eighth factor of right stillness. So those two will go together the next time. But the next time will be quite a while because I am disappearing from your presence to do my retreat. So the next Saturday will be about 3 weeks' time, is it? Yeah, 3 weeks' time. And then we'll carry on with Nibbana Anapanasati and what's the other one through Samadhi, and then the last class will be about the gradual development, which is another way of putting in the Eightfold Path. Okay. Yes, you can, yes.
So there isn't actually all that much in here about contemplation of feelings in the sense that
indeed
the way you talked about
Yes.
But possibly the way that the sutra is actually written, it probably isn't that important at that stage.
No, it isn't. It's a good practice to get one, again, away from the thinking mind, like so many sort of intellectuals are just... Now, we've been trained to be so much in our head. Yeah. At least we're getting mostly into our bodily feelings of heat and cold, which is a great way of sort of settling you down. So it has a great sort of a purpose in getting you some distance from the intellectualizing. Yes. And then after that, it does actually calm you down a lot. And it does give you a sense of freedom from worrying about feelings in the body. But obviously, how I've taught for a long time now, I strongly believe that that particular contemplation has to be done because it's connected with the body, it's bodily feelings rather than other feelings, yes. So that you can let this body disappear.
Okay. And, I must get that from this five interests. There is life in me, there is this in me, this kind of knowing comes from this sutta.
Yeah, well,
is that the idea for that?
Yeah, but it's not really noting, it's not verbalizing it, it's just knowing.
I know, but pick that up and implement it.
Yeah.
And there's one other thing. In the Agamas, the breathing meditation, which is the first in the Vajrayana Nikaya, the
Oh, yes,
it's,
I see.
It's not first.
Yes, yes.
It's the four possible.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yes.
It's an interesting.
It is, yeah, but not put it in
there. It's easier to do.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
That's right, yes. Because the other part of it is a very refined practice. Yeah, there will be a Monday Dhamma talk. It's been voted on. So there'll be another Dhamma talk on Monday night, but the next Word of the Buddha class is in 2 or 3 weeks' time.